From the Sky News Centre at 6, relatives of those killed in the Lockerbie bombing say we should remember the victims, not the terrorist convicted of murdering them. Abdelbaset al-Megrahi was released from prison on compassionate grounds because he had terminal cancer, but he's still alive a year on. Rabbi Stephanie Bernstein, whose husband was killed in the bombing, says today's a painful reminder for the victims' families.
So many children lost parents, parents lost their only children, and this was a grave injustice. It was an abrogation of justice that was done when Megrahi was released.
The Israeli Prime Minister has welcomed an invitation from the US for face-to-face talks with the Palestinians. They're due to be held in Washington on September the 2nd. It'll be the first face-to-face meeting between the two for 19 months. US Peace Envoy George Mitchell compared the challenge to one a little closer to home.
In a sense, in Northern Ireland, we had about 700 days of failure in one day of success. And we approach this task with the same determination to succeed.
Second World War aircraft have roared over the rooftops of London once again this afternoon as hundreds gathered to recognise 70 years since the Battle of Britain. Ex-fighter pilots and relatives of war heroes join the commemorations. Around 150 climate camp activists in Edinburgh have held a dance party in the Royal Bank of Scotland HQ after breaching security. One protester disguised as a banker superglued her hands to the front desk. Charities have criticised government plans to withdraw welfare benefits from drug addicts who refuse treatment. They say there's no evidence it'll work and the idea could breach medical principles. Alistair Cook's provided the only ray of light for England on an otherwise dark day in the third test with Pakistan at the Oval. He cast aside his recent poor form to hit a century. The hosts closed on 221 for 9 in their second innings, which is a lead of 146 runs. That's the latest. I'm
Bristol Tim Community
Jones.
FM 93.2. Your voice, your choice.
Bristol Street Map, your audio A to Z. Radio show launch party, Friday the 20th of August at the Left Bank Bar, Cheltenham Road. With live entertainment from Krantz and Francis Mary, Julie Baker, Ricky Gallimore and Douglas McLeod, Tia Coles and DJs Ned Kelly and Patrick Coughlin. Hosted by Eddie King. Starts at 8 o'clock and finishes at 2 a.m. and it's just £3 on the door. Bristol Street Map, your audio A to Z.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.
Welcome back to Friday Drive Time with old Labour economist Martin Summers and me, Tony Gosling. Well, no summer break from politicians would be complete without the Bristol anarchists. With Social Security apparently about to be dismantled, just as people are being sacked, pay is being cut, pay is being frozen, alternatives to mainstream politics might begin to make more sense. We go inside a squatted social centre in St Paul's where nobody pays any rent. Are they scroungers or just trying to put a roof over their head and make ends meet? But first, former US Ambassador to the United Nations John Bolton said this week that the West must bomb Iran's nuclear facilities by the 25th of August. Well, that's next Wednesday, to stop their uranium enrichment programme. Some other news stories are saying they must do it by today. So is this the prelude to another war, or is this just more sabre-rattling to divert attention from the real targets, which may be Pakistan or Afghanistan? Why is it that almost daily at the moment there are stories in the national media about what a terrible regime is in power in Tehran, even on BBC Radio 4 Long Wave's usually sacred daily service? Is this genuine unbiased reporting, or is it linked to the consolidation of American power in Iraq? US Admiral Mike Mullen's threat that he has a plan to attack Iran, or John Bolton's threat this week, as I said, that Israel and the US must attack Iran's nuclear power facilities? Or is it the fact that the Iranians are sitting on so much oil? Well, I put the question to the author of George Bush Sr., The Unauthorized Biography. He makes regular appearances on Moscow's English language TV network, Russia Today, and his name is Webster Tarpley.
I want to call your attention to this U.S. attack, Israeli attack on Iran. This is back now. The danger for about 2.5 years was very low, practically nothing. And now it's getting very, very high. The neocons are making a comeback. Petraeus is the leader of the neocons, right? He's their presidential candidate. The neocons are coming back with Petraeus. Obama's a pathetic weakling, and he's, you know, he's just as happy to go along with this stuff. Right, it's a big, big shift, and you really got to see this. Right, it's not just the standard patter about Iran for the last couple of years. Right, it's a very important change. The U.S. is now in 11 countries. They've ringed Iran with everything, right? It's Turkey, Iraq, Azerbaijan, Armenia, United Arab Emirates, Pakistan, Afghanistan, Kyrgyzia, probably more. Plus, there are now two carrier battle groups there. One just, there's this armada went through the Suez Canal. The Israelis have nuclear missile submarines. They're keeping one in the Persian Gulf now at all times. So the Israelis are in a furor, and there's all this stuff about the Israelis and the U.S. have got these essentially bases in Saudi Arabia. Saudi Arabia is happy to be used for a flyover. All these characters are saying that the Saudis and the United Arab Emirates are clamoring for the attack. We indeed had the UAE ambassador to the U.S. in Aspen, Colorado, about 2 weeks ago, did this tirade where he says, you know, we're out there and we want you to do it. We're sick of Iran. You know, we're happy to run the risk, right? So you go ahead and do it. And then the main neocon magazine, the Weekly Standard, the cover story is why Israel should attack Iran now. And the U.S. can like it or lump it. They'll cooperate.
Well, that was U.S. author Webster Tarpley, and you can catch him quite regularly on the satellite channel Russia Today. Now, Martin, are there indications that the Western powers are actually encircling Iran?
I think they certainly are. I mean, U.S. troops are in virtually all the countries surrounding Iran in thousands.
So what's your analysis of this? Is it saber-rattling? Do you think they're just making a fuss again, or what?
Well, I mean, I think the saber-rattling itself is unacceptable. I mean, this is what people have got to wake up to. You can't go around threatening to punch people in the mouth.
Well, what they're doing here is threatening to bomb their nuclear facilities.
Yes, but I mean, in normal life, if I was to threaten to punch you in the mouth, that's as virtually as bad as doing it. And these threats to Iran are extremely unhelpful and terribly provocative. I mean, if the Iranians were to follow the Bush doctrine of preemptive strike, they wouldn't wait until they were hit. They would hit back first, wouldn't they? Well, and that's one of the problems with making threats, isn't it?
The science of this is a bit weird, though, isn't it? Because it's almost as if just by enriching uranium for nuclear power, that is just as bad as building a bomb. It's what it seems.
Well, it's totally unfair and unreasonable. The Iranians, I'm not a particular fan of nuclear power, but they have as much right to have it as anybody else. This is the Bushehr reactor, which Bolton is saying that they should bomb, and it's about to go online because the Russians, who've helped to build it, are about to put it online as a nuclear reactor. Now, basically, the Iranians are within their rights to have a nuclear reactor, just as we are, if we want one, and there's no justification for bombing them or even threatening to bomb them. And in actual fact, it's not about that anyway, as Webster was pointing out. It's a geopolitical game. They're after the oil. They want to break the regime. You know, it's the game of risk being played by the neocons. And haven't we had enough bloodshed already? Do the British people really want another war with an even bigger potential loss of life than the last two? I don't think so.
Now, Moscow is seriously concerned about the possibility of a further war in the Middle East. Every Friday, Californian Dan Roberts releases his weekly podcast. It's called The Shortwave Report. It takes extracts from shortwave radio broadcasts around the world. Dan is a sort of one-man version of the BBC monitoring service in Caversham. This week's report included a perspective on events that we're simply not getting from the national press here in Britain, from the voice of Russia.
Tehran's nuclear program has become what might be called a cornerstone in its relationship with the United States. Economic sanctions have rallied Iranians against Washington and its allies. Is a U.S. invasion of Iran possible, and what effect will it have? Rajab Safadov, General Director of the Center for Modern Iran, fears the world is on the brink of a global conflict.
Отсутствие позиции России или пассивная позиция дает возможность Западу более нагло.
I think, he says, that the passive position of Russia enables the West to behave more boldly and cynically towards Iran. Russia is a major player in the international political arena. If it sticks to a position that an invasion or any other military solution to the Iranian issue must not take place under any circumstances, then Americans will adjust their plans on Iran. In Mr. Safadov's view, the key aim the Americans have in mind is a change of regime in Iran. Barack Obama intends to pull troops out of Iraq, but instead of going home, they will be moved to Afghanistan. As long as the current Iranian regime stays in power, the United States can hardly hope to attain success in either Iraq or Afghanistan. A massive attack against Iran can create the illusion that the Obama administration has won, but only for a short time. Maxim Kalashnikov, an essayist and futurologist, feels that a military scenario is not unlikely. He said that for the American elite that has long become transnational, Iran is a Gordian knot. the cutting of which could help drive recession outside the U.S. economy. In that case, the Caspian Sea will be divided along the central line and pipelines will be turned towards Europe. The split of Iran will cut off the fast-growing Chinese and Indian economies from hydrocarbons. While Europe and the United States were absorbed in playing post-industrialism, the industry moved to China and India, to Asia. A possible U.S. strike against Iran will probably be a mix of an air and media attack with an attempt to bribe the local elite and stoke separatism. First the Kurdish and then the Azeri ones. The U.S. will have no need to bomb the whole of Iran, but just to cut off Khuzestan, whose oil and gas complexes feed the entire nation. Essayist and futurologist Maxim Kalashnikov ended this report from our correspondent, Vladimir Golovkin.
The United States must remove its tactical nuclear arms from Europe, former chief of the International Atomic Energy Agency, Hans Blix, said in an interview with the Global Security Newswire. More from the Voice of Russia observer Viktor Yenikeyev. Mr. Blix touched upon a pressing international issue which has a direct relation to the European security, as well as relations between Russia and the United States, Russia and NATO. Moscow, Washington, and Brussels have long been involved in talks on this matter, but nowadays it appears to be the most favorable time to make a real breakthrough in these negotiations. Certainly, progress can be achieved only in case a new strategic arms reduction treaty is signed by the Russian and American leaders in Prague in early April and is ratified by both parliaments. If the treaty is ratified, status of the United States' nuclear arsenal in Europe, their plans to deploy anti-missile elements in Eastern Europe, as well as agreements on middle and small-range missiles, will be brought to foreground. Still, it is important to keep in mind that the U.S. tactical arms could be transported to the Russian borders within a few minutes. Russia has repeatedly urged the United States to pull its tactical arms from Europe, for America remains the only country having a stockpile of bombs outside its territory. The weapons are thought to be located at bases in Belgium, Germany, Italy, the Netherlands, and Turkey. It is remarkable that the position of Moscow is shared by many prominent U.S. citizens, including former high-ranking army officers, diplomats, and scholars. They wrote letters to George W. Bush and the current U.S. President Barack Obama asking to accept Russia's proposal. MPs in Germany, the Netherlands, Luxembourg, and Norway would also urge the United States administration to withdraw nuclear arms from Europe. But all those efforts were in vain. Washington insists that its tactical arms remain within NATO. But doesn't it look strange that the United States and NATO Secretary General Anders Fogh Rasmussen justify their position by saying there is a need for keeping the nukes in Europe as means of deterrence? The question is whom they are going to deter. Their intention reminds of the Cold War era policies, which is absolutely out of tune with the reset of Russia-U.S. relations. That was a report by Viktor Yenikeyev.
Those reports were from the Voice of Russia through World Radio Network at WRN.org. There's an updated frequency guide at the website for this show. One of my goals in producing this show is to encourage people to listen to international broadcast using a shortwave radio at home, which is far simpler than you might think. However, if you use the internet, listening globally is also quite easy. See the links at this program's website. Every Friday morning, I post a new shortwave report at the website for this show. That's www.outfarpress.com. At my website, you can also listen to past shows, find internet links for international broadcasters, make a safe donation through PayPal, and get advice for listening at home. The Shortwave Report is free to rebroadcast upon notification. The Shortwave Report is produced and distributed off the electrical grid in Northern California using solar panels. I'm your host and producer, Dan Roberts. Thanks for listening.
Yes, that was Dan Roberts with his weekly shortwave report, which is uploaded every Friday. And specifically, we were hearing there from the Voice of Russia. Now, Martin, there was two aspects of that. One was looking at Iran and the other was looking at American nuclear weapons in Europe. I mean, I didn't actually realise there were so many American nukes in Europe. And he's also saying that these are there for deterrence.
Yes, as well as the report pointed out, the Germans and others have already asked for these nukes to be removed, and they've been unceremoniously told no. So that just shows who's wearing the trousers, as it were, in that relationship. Of course, another irritant for the Russians is these anti-missile missiles, which have gone into Poland, Romania, which of course are supposedly directed at Iran. Goodness knows why a missile has to go into eastern Poland to prevent an attack on from Iran, but the Russians obviously interpret this as basically directed at them. Simultaneously with that, we've had exercises against North Korea after the sinking of this ship, which possibly wasn't sunk by the North Koreans at all. We've got a huge increase in forces in Costa Rica, which the Venezuelans perceive as a threat. And we've got this massive build-up in the Gulf, with I think three or four carrier battle groups now heading into the Gulf for a confrontation with Iran. Now, this, frankly, is all bonkers. There is no reason for the US and NATO to go around trying to conquer the world. It's a fool's errand, but sadly, I'm afraid not much has changed with the change of administration from Bush to Obama in the US. It looks like, frankly, the military-industrial complex have got a lock on policy, and it doesn't really matter who's elected.
Now, he mentioned there also, Radio Moscow did, this idea of an air and media attack if there is an attack on Iran.
Well, yes, and also in linking this with tactical nuclear missiles, I understand that the US has developed a specific nuclear missile for use against Iran, which is a low-yield micro-nuke, and therefore supposedly safe for civilians, but it's still about the same kiloton yield as the Hiroshima bomb. But what, of course, they're saying, and apparently they've done war games, Admiral Mullen's done various war games, and the only way, in fact, that the Pentagon have found to defeat Iran is to use such micro-nukes. If they fought a conventional war against Iran, they would lose. And I think they deserve to lose, because people who go around invading other people's countries when they've got no reason and no excuse deserve to be beaten.
Well, yes, but it may be that they can sort of do this from a distant position, maybe bombing from the air rather than actually invading the country.
Yes, but they will still kill a lot of people, and the Iranians will regard that as an attack on them. So if that happens and the Royal Navy are involved, it's time for everyone to put their tin hats on in Bristol, isn't it? Because if we're going to go and bomb Iran, people have got to get ready for Iran to bomb us. It's like World War II, isn't it?
I know Ahmadinejad has said that if there is an attack on Iran, that the West will get a big surprise. Any idea what that big surprise
is? I wouldn't like to speculate, but most of the assessment is that the US military is long on equipment and poor on actual delivery in terms of winning wars. The Iranians, who defeated the Iraqis basically in the 1980s, have got a much bigger, they've got an army the same size as the Americans, but it's all in Iran. The American army's all over the place. The Gulf, in fact, is a killing ground potentially for shorter ship missiles. And on the first day of the war, the US could lose a couple of aircraft carriers. That'd be 20,000 men down the drain. I think it would be extremely foolish to attack Iran, so foolish that it's stupid to even threaten it. But people are talking, serious politicians, even mainstream centrist politicians, oh, if we don't threaten Iran, they won't do as we say. This is silly playground talk. Start talking seriously to the Iranians about everything, not threatening them with attack. Because, of course, if I was the Iranians, I would say, don't threaten us. Just like the Vietnamese did, you threaten us, we will beat you. And the US has not won a single war since 1945. Not one, despite all the huffing and puffing. Oh, Grenada. They won in Grenada. But everywhere else, they've been beaten. And they deserve to be beaten, frankly.
Now, looking still at the Middle East, both sides in the Israel-Palestine conflict seem to believe that God is on their side. Pastor John Haggie, who we heard talking about Social Security last week, is one of the foremost so-called preachers from the Christian right faction known as the Christian Zionists. He takes a controversial position that the state of Israel is inspired by God, and over in the United States, he uses the argument that the Bible actually endorses Israel's occupation of Palestine, which is illegal under international law. He believes that, as he says, if America puts pressure on Israel to give up the occupied territories, that God will wreak vengeance on the United States.
To give up more land for peace. Joel 3:2 says, any nation that tries to get Israel to divide my land, I will bring it into judgment. I want those of you in the State Department and in government in Washington to hear this. If America does not stop pressuring Israel to give up land, I believe that God will bring this nation into judgment, because I believe what this book says. And if God brings this nation into judgment, he will very likely release the terrorists that you've already let get here through the ridiculous immigration policy you refuse to stop. And this nation is going to go through a bloodbath that you have permitted because of what you have done. You have disobeyed the law of God.
That's Pastor John Hagee there, Christian Zionist. Now, Martin, how typical do you think is Pastor John Hagee of Christians in the US?
He's not typical of Christians in general, but he's typical of a certain strand of political opinion in the US, which people in Britain need to listen to a lot more. They also need to listen to the Israeli government's statements a lot more, because what these people are saying is that as far as they're concerned, the end of the world is nigh. And the good book tells them, whether it's the Old Testament or the Old Testament and the New Testament put together, that the end of the world is nigh and that we're going to have to go to Armageddon for the rapture and we're all going to be rescued by God. Now, when Cameron tells us that we've got to take a strong line on Iran, what people have got to realise is that behind US policy is this kind of craziness. Every bit as crazy as Osama bin Laden, if he's still alive, if he still exists, if he's not still working for the CIA. These people are frankly bonkers. The sort of ravings we just heard there would make Goebbels sound rational. But these people are driving policy, and people should wake up. These threats against Iran are a threat of World War III. And that could easily happen just by accident now, just like World War I. There could be a flare-up in Lebanon, which leads to an exchange with Iran and Israel, and off we go. Nuclear weapons will be used. That could happen before the end of the year. But people are sleepwalking into this, as they did in August 1914, as they did in August 1939. And we're still, most people in Britain are completely oblivious to this, but this is a really dangerous moment.
Now, the big question, of course, is there also a Christian Zionist faction in the UK?
Well, there is, but they're not so influential, and they tend to keep their heads down. We're not exposed to the craziness of US media as much as we ought to be. People ought to be forced to watch Fox News every night to realise how mad our allies actually are.
Forced to be?
Well, I mean, the point is that we get a sanitised version of the Israeli right and the US right here. Basically, they're quite rational, but there's a few extremists. Whereas what we need to realise is that a lot of people driving policy in Israel and the US do not understand British values at all. They're on a completely different planet.
Thanks very much, Martin. Well, as repossessions increase and mortgages become very difficult to obtain, more and more people are finding themselves homeless. If all else fails, squatting may be the only option, certainly better than sleeping in the street or in a doorway. Well, I'm joined now by Kai, who's an activist from a squatted social centre, The Factory. Hi, Kai.
Hi there.
Now, you were involved, to start with in the occupation of the proposed new Tesco local up on Stokes Cross and Cheltenham Road. Why did you get involved in that?
Basically, in the past, I've just been getting involved in small-time politics and local politics around the areas which I've been living in. The Tesco's occupation was a project that a few of us took on at a very last-minute thing, because we found out that Tesco's was trying to slip in underneath the local community's authorities, basically.
What's your objection to Tesco's, per se, then, in that area?
Basically, there's at least two Tesco's within about a mile radius of that place that they want to build the Tesco's in. And Tesco's themselves are actually a multinational company who are around, there's about 32 in the Bristol and surrounding areas, which pretty much takes a monopoly over the whole of Bristol. So it affects the local community widely, like very, very much so.
Well, I think also one of the some of the people who were complaining about Tesco's being there were also the little local traders who felt they were going to be squeezed out. Now, onto the factory, which is in St Paul's, which is a squatted social centre. Where is the factory and how did you acquire the building?
Basically, the factory is a large old building on the corner of Cave Street, just off Portland Square in St Paul's. It used to be a boot factory and a paper mill at one point. And there was a group of activists who have been involved in squatting in Bristol for a number of years now. And they have been planning basically to set up a permanent social centre within a working class area and hopefully quite local to the community that actually needs a social centre.
But how did you actually acquire the building? Did you actually break in?
The building itself was unattended. There was nobody looking after the building. And a lot of the rundown buildings in Bristol are left very unsecure. So the actual access of the building was very easy to do. There was no criminal damage done. And since opening the space up, we've had a lot of people from the community come in and say a lot of good things about the building.
But surely squatting is illegal?
No, there's definitely laws in the UK saying that squatting is legal. There's a Section 6, which is the legal rights, explaining to people who decide to occupy buildings and live in them, that provide a legal a chance to live in a building that's empty for housing and also projects for community, and as much as the people inside want to use it for.
But it's not really fair, is it? Because you're not paying any rent while lots of the people around you are.
The majority of people that live inside squats are people who are already, would say, on the breadline. They're already being pushed down by the economy's like problems, and they've ended up having to result in the lowest forms of, in public's eyes, the lowest form of kind of housing. And for most people that end up squatting, this is the best option, and they don't actually try and kind of outcast themselves from the community. And the factory itself is very actively involved with the community and is hoping to provide something much more than anything that the government could provide.
So how long has your collective been in there?
We occupied the building at the beginning of March this year, and since then we've been working on totally revamping the whole building. There was flooding from the roof coming in, no electrics in the building, lots of damp, lots of work that had to be done, like a long period of time. And we've made a residential area, and we've made an area which is suitable for the public to come in and come explore the building.
So why do you do that? Because I mean, you know, you could be fixing up the building, repairing it, it's quite a lot of work, and then all of a sudden suddenly you're evicted.
That's very true, but with the economic crisis, I believe, that's happening now, that we have to take our like problems into our own hands, and that to get actual buildings out there providing services to the community seems to be priority. But that's, in my eyes as an activist from Bristol, one of the key problems that the government don't address, and we need to have a lot more community spaces available for the public to get involved in. There's not much of a involvement process there for community centres. It's a process that you have to pay, and you have to have an agreement that you will respect their rules. And with squatting and with social centres, it works in a very different way. There's non-hierarchical positioning. All the decisions are made consensually. So everything that happens there is equal for everybody.
Now, Martin, if I can bring you in here, do you think this is something, as the recession may possibly, quite possibly, does a double dip and continues, that we're going to be seeing more of this kind of thing?
I think we are, yes, certainly. And of course, another possible growth of squatting is when people are evicted from their houses because they can't pay the rent or because they can't pay the mortgage. They may decide to take the option of changing the locks and squatting their own properties. And I think possibly the only thing that's going to stop mass evictions, if there is a double dip recession, is that if people do refuse to leave the properties that they're already in and basically become squatters. Now, for a lot of people, that's a bit of a dangerous step, and they didn't really know what was going to happen. This happened in the building where I live. I'm still renting, but two people downstairs were evicted and squatters moved into those flats. I think it's very important that people who've got experience of squatting, like Kai here, are ready to advise more mainstream people who are going to be pushed in this direction because of what happens. Because if there is a double dip, lots of people are going to lose their roof over their heads. It makes no sense. In the US, millions of people have been kicked out of their houses. They've walked away, and the houses have now just deteriorated to the point where they're being knocked down. So you've got people sleeping in cars. The houses they used to live in have turned into an uninhabitable mess. And it's just completely ridiculous. The obvious thing to do is for the whole the society as a whole to turn around and say, no, kicking people out on the street is simply not an option. If that causes bankruptcies on the, then that's just too bad. I mean, we've got to actually put a bottom under the recession, depression, and that requires people to defend themselves through organisation, which is why I commend what these people are doing.
But practically, what would you do, you know, if you haven't managed to pay your mortgage, then you're starting to get nasty letters from the bank, then suddenly you're summoned to court and the bailiffs come round. What, practically, what can you actually do?
Well, I think Kai can probably answer that better than I can.
I would actually suggest that if you're suggesting that people who have a building and have people occupying it already, that they go and they ask advice with the squatters and communicate as much as possible with the squatters, so they have a very good understanding of where they're coming from.
Well, I know there's something called the Squatters Handbook, isn't there, that you can get, which has got all the legalities and also things to do with, you know, for example, you don't have to be paying rent, but you can be have all of the utilities like gas, electricity, water, and all that can be perfectly legal, even though you're not necessarily paying rent for a place. So practically, though, what happens if, I mean, people may just leave it until the bailiffs come round, mightn't they?
That's correct, yeah.
And what happens in a situation like that?
For example, when I was in the Jester's building, we had a legal right to be living in the building to start with, but then after the process went through of us being evicted, as soon as we knew that was happening, it turned more into a protest site. We knew that we weren't allowed to be in the building legally for much longer, so we took things into our own hands and collected a lot of items out on the street, old washing machines, many other things, and barricaded ourselves in the building. We also had a tripod on the top of the building, which somebody sits on the top of, and hopefully prevents or at least prolongs the process for eviction.
Well, that's a bit of extreme measures. What about the first process with the possession order, and would you recommend people go to court?
If you want to go to court, that's definitely advisable. If you want to try and prolong your the process and hopefully even win the case, I would say. Most of the time, people can go into a court case and be anonymous and represent for the people occupying the building for them. This usually results in something that doesn't actually follow through and be helpful, but it's always worth a try because it has happened before and people have won their own case.
And I think quite often landlords don't expect the squatters to turn up in court.
That's right.
Well, now last weekend at the factory, there was an open day where local people, well, anyone actually, could come and have a look around the building and see what the squatters have been up to in there. So I took the opportunity to ask two members of the collective and a visitor what there was to see.
Lots of people came, there was lots of cake, lots of people ate the cake. There's still some cake left. Sorry, I've been on the tea and cake stall, so I'm kind of focused on the cake. Sorry.
I think different people kind of take different things from it or bring different things to it. I mean, we've got a load of different workshops and things going on some of the time. Like, there's been martial arts kind of stuff that goes on. There's trapeze workshops. This month we're hosting the Men Against Patriarchy meetings. Gardening projects going on. There's a lot of work that we're doing on the building to make it more usable. And
well, some people think actually, you know, this is not on, and you should be paying rent.
I don't think anyone should be paying rent. No, that's somebody else having control of your life, forcing you into a situation where you have to be a part of the monetary systems that are there. You lose power and lose part of your essence of existing through that. That's not the way I choose to live my life.
But you put a lot of work into the building, but I mean, you could be actually evicted any time. Isn't that maybe a waste of time?
Yeah, but so's working to pay your mortgage, mate.
That's true. I mean, you could be renting and then all of a sudden they'll sell the house and you have to move out. So all the energy you put in working to pay the rent to stay in one place is gone. You don't have any stability as a renter. They're looking at making it so you won't even have any stability if you manage to get a council house. You've got almost as much stability here, and here you have control over the space. You get to decide, you know, what your rooms will look like, what the kitchen will be like. It's a different form of work.
It's experiment in living together and different ways we can live together for everyone to benefit the most out of.
Because this building's so large, it works quite well because you can have two entire stories of space for public events, for social events. And then there's the two stories above that is the kind of residence area. So it actually works quite well just because this building is so extraordinarily large. And it's been empty for ages. it's, you know, people have occupied it now, and so it just means that there is space for people who wouldn't have space to run a workshop, to get together without having to pay a bunch of money to someone else.
It does. I mean, it's a bit of a valuable bit of property here, isn't it? Right in close to the city centre in Bristol. Do you have any idea why it's been empty for such a long time? I think it's nearly 20 years.
My personal theory is the owner, because it's listed, he can't knock it down. I reckon it's worth more to him selling it once it's fallen apart. So we're ruining his plans a bit by making sure it doesn't fall apart. We've had to do stuff like fixing the roof, because all the lead was nicked. So we've been flashing the roof. We had to get one of those big suction truck things to clear the drains out, because they weren't in the best state underneath it. We've been doing building work to make it usable space in the social centre space and usable living space. Just involved loads of plumbing, building kitchens, building bathrooms, loads of partitioning of rooms, loads of painting. Almost every DIY kind of project you can think of we've started or got on with.
What is a social centre? Is it just like a sort of community centre that, you know, how does it work? How does it operate?
Here we try to be completely non-hierarchical. Everyone's free to, like, suggest things to be done in the space or get on with doing things in the space. And it's decided by everyone. In the Thursday meetings at, I don't know, I always turn up late to them.
Seven.
And, yeah, they're open meetings that everyone can come and get involved with. I've also got to mention a couple of projects. There's an apothecary project going on, kind of herbalism, and people are making their own tinctures and learning about how to use plants and stuff for their own health. Yeah, and we've got loads of equipment and stuff to do that with that we've gathered together.
I don't know if you were here for the food, the cafe. It was amazing, amazing food from vegetables that would have otherwise just been chucked away. One of the rooms is going to be turned into a kind of full, kind of professional standard kitchen for a kind of a regular free cafe, and also for kind of cooking workshops. And
the supermarkets actually chuck away lots and lots of food, don't they? And it does bother me that some of the supermarkets even do things like putting bleach and dye onto the food. Have you come across that?
There was no bleach or dye in the food.
Do you have an attitude to the supermarkets?
Yeah, I hate them. Through freeganism and taking their excess food.
What is freeganism?
Choosing to eat food that you're not paying for.
This is food that maybe has just passed its sell-by date, or else similar sort of stuff, more allotment growing, that kind of thing.
Or hasn't even made it from the wholesaler. Capitalism's meant to be this incredibly efficient system that's able to satisfy all of our needs and wants, but it's actually incredibly inefficient in terms of waste, and then in terms of other people not having access to enough food, or to the right type of food, or to fresh vegetables, strange exotic vegetables that you'd have to pay I don't know how much for if you were buying them. They're just chucking them in the bin. So the aim is to get that and to share it, look after ourselves and everyone around.
I guess we kind of, in opposition to capitalism, live off its inefficiencies, both with food and the housing, and use that as a method to give ourselves time and space to start creating an alternative to it.
The Russians have recently talked about stopping all grain exports the other day because they're having problems with... Do you think we've got a bit complacent about our food security, that maybe we can't grow all the food we need in Britain?
I think definitely, and people are too far away from growing it. Like, a lot of us don't know where our food comes from or what goes into it. The more we can bring it back to ourselves and take things into our own hands, the better. We've got an email, website even. It's freefactory.wordpress.com.
I'm really impressed. I forgot to introduce myself. Okay. My name's Farai. I like the way that the space has really been used and turned around for sort of the benefit of the community as well, and that they've got an open day at all, so that people can come and just see for themselves and check it out, and sort of hopefully break down a few of the sort of stereotypical barriers and ideas of what it is to squat and to be a squatter and stuff like that. I think that it's very creative. I've just seen a film they've just put on, which was really good, about consumerism and all that kind of stuff, so it's educational as well.
Yeah.
I just think it's such a shame that buildings like this are empty for so long and not used, not allowed to be turned into some sort of project for the community, or, you know, just the size of this as well has just blown me away. I didn't realise how big it was, like three or four floors. look at what benefit is today, like just bringing us all together and just having a nosy round, really. It's what I'm doing. Yeah, I don't know why empty buildings cause such a problem for people when they're squatted, really.
Yeah, because actually, I mean, I know the fire brigade get really annoyed because they quite often get broken into empty buildings. Just last week, there was a big fire just on the other side of the square, which is actually on the news, you know, because it was such a massive fire. And this is quite a serious problem. A lot of the authorities think that buildings like this should be used. What do you think about the way that this group have put the building to?
That's great. Great, I really think it's great, because I think I heard somebody mentioning that before, this building was sort of, you know, not used to the best, and it was just sort of like a party sort of building. I think this use on sort of open days and, you know, putting on events and, you know, stuff like that, it's just fantastic.
Now, I spoke to a lady across the road recently, and she was saying that, at least it keeps the drunks off the streets.
Drunks. At least it keeps the drunks off the street. So she's insinuating that all squatters are drunks and sort of no hopers, really. Oh, well, she should come to the open day, shouldn't she?
Freefactory.wordpress.com.
So that was the open day down at the factory, which is in St Paul's, just on Portland Square, about 10 days ago or so. I'm joined in the studio by Kai, who's one of the activists from the factory. Now, can you just say, do you think it would be right to describe the factory collective as anarchists?
I think the principles from the actual main core group of people who help set the building up have a lot of anarchist principles, but I wouldn't say that it forefronts anarchist belief as something just that's the only solution to our problems in society.
Well, what is an anarchist anyway? Maybe Martin, you want to chip in on this as well?
Well, it's a very old intellectual tradition in the labour movement, particularly. The anarchists were big players in the Spanish Civil War, for example. They're involved in factory occupations, attempts to try and build a new society from below. This week, for example, Jimmy Reed died, who led the Upper Clyde Shipbuilders working in 1971, and lots of the great and the good, including Gordon Brown, went to his funeral. But of course, that could be argued as an example of anarchism in action, in the sense of direct action. Don't just lobby your MP, occupy the shipyard which you're being kicked out of, and take direct action. I mean, that's the real key to anarchism, is to do things on the ground and not just wait for somebody to do them for you. I personally don't think that that's enough in itself, but of course I'm certainly in favour of people doing things rather than doing nothing, because otherwise we're passive, aren't we?
So what would you, are you saying that that is the core principle of anarchism?
No, the core principle of anarchism is of course no hierarchies, no states, no government, and that sounds like utopian, but of course anarchist movements traditionally have been involved in social struggles, like the Spanish Civil War, for example, but not just there. And the Mexican Revolution, a large section of the people involved in that were anarchists.
One of the dilemmas there, of course, is that many anarchists are anti-globalisation, and yet they're saying that there shouldn't be any governments. Now, that seems to me like...
No, there's no contradiction there. There should be international solidarity, but not capitalist globalisation. I mean, the two things are actually opposites, aren't they?
Anyway, back to the factory itself. Last time, apparently, the factory was actually squatted last year, and there were actually lots of things like late night parties there. So, is your mission a bit different to when it was squatted last time, Kai?
It's definitely a completely different format, our building. Beforehand, it started off as accommodation as the priority for the homeless in Bristol, slowly evolved into more of a project with the community and having different events in the building. Unfortunately, because a lot of the people that were involved in it were people who had backgrounds of drug use and partying and things that involve lots of people just abusing spaces, I would say. Unfortunately, got back into a bad habit of taking advantage of that building. And the project now is run by a different group of people. And since the last occupation, we've already had many feedbacks from the community saying great things about the group.
So do you have sort of any sort of rules and principles? I mean, cause I don't know, maybe I'm wrong, but I think of anarchists as not having rules. But do you have rules and principles to do with drug use and alcohol?
There's definitely... set in stone, sort of, we would so to say, a policy, but the policy is actually still to be interpreted by each individual. We do have a safer spaces policy, which involves in the community space having no alcohol, no drinking, and we're basically respecting your surroundings, so one another, and also abusing the building, because we've had in the past other buildings we've seen being abused, where they people graffiti it and many other things. Since we've been in the building, the first few months were just spending time whitewashing over the old graffiti of the building.
So how do you actually run the building? I mean, you have a weekly meeting, I believe. How does that all work?
We have a weekly meeting on Thursdays at 7 p.m, which involves having the core group of people, or at least a number of the core group, which are residents of the building, being present there to facilitate, which is basically chairing the meeting to help keep the efficiency of the meeting. It's open for anybody to come along, as long as they respect the policy, so to say. The way that the process is in the meetings is that there's no hierarchical positioning. The facilitator just helps keep the flow of the meeting going. All decisions are made consensual, so that's everybody has a fair say, and everything happens with group occupation.
Well, I mean, it's easy to talk about consensus, but I mean, this is practically almost impossible, isn't it? If you've got two people in the meeting who've got completely opposite points of view.
When you have a case like this, there's basic ruling within decision facilitation and consensual decision making, where if you disagree with somebody, if it's something that you disagree with but you don't want to jeopardize the go ahead with the project as a whole, you'll stand aside from the project, from this decision, and that's doesn't happen very rarely.
Does it mean that sometimes you have very long time to actually make a decision? I can imagine, you know, it could take almost hours to actually reach a decision. If you've got lots and lots of people in the meeting, everybody wants to have their say, this could be, you know, take ages.
It can take a long time, yes. Sometimes the meetings have dragged on in between maybe an hour and a half to 2 hours, but when you have about 30 people plus during the meeting, the facilitator has to try and kind of keep the flow of it to make sure that it doesn't stagnate. And if a subject, like a different point, goes on for too long, they will ask people as a group if it's okay to come back to this in a future meeting. If it's a very important one, it will drag on. But the point of this is it's all experimental techniques, which I believe the process is a far more productive thing than the actions themselves. The process of learning how we are going to make decisions in the future, I would say, is something that's far more valued.
Martin, I mean, do you think that this is a bit of an inefficient way of running a building? Is it, you know, sort of rather slow?
Well, I mean, the playwright Oscar Wilde, who was a socialist, said once socialism would never work because it would take too many evenings. And he was joking, of course, because he was in fact a socialist. What I think is that in small enough groups where people know each other well enough, consensus decision making can be extremely effective. But I doubt whether you can actually run everything on that basis. I think some form of representational democracy is inevitable. But I think that experimenting with different kinds of running meetings, different kinds of ways of doing things is very important, because we tend to get stuck in a rut and think there's only one way of doing things. In actual fact, there's quite a variety of different ways of doing things. And consensus decisions are best when you've got small groups who've got very strong shared values, because then, of course, you can actually usually argue your way to a conclusion. But then you've got to accept sometimes that people are going to disagree, and that's obviously what often happens is collective split at that point, and people go off in one direction and do one thing, people go off in another direction and do something else. I think it's very important to experiment with organisational forms, but we must also get things done, because that's action is the life of all, as anarchists will no doubt agree.
Now, Kai, let's get back to the sort of practicalities, day-to-day stuff. Some of the food you get is past its sell-by date and from skips. Now, surely that's not safe, is it?
The food itself, the sell-by date, that's led to believe to be condemned and we must throw it all away, actually, in my eyes, is something that the government has installed just as a get-out plan for all these companies. So they actually are legally allowed to throw the waste away. The thing is with waste, there's so much waste from the supermarkets because of the process that they use. It's not very efficient, and it doesn't actually benefit the communities apart from these small subcultures.
Now, I know that some supermarkets take really extreme lengths to make sure that as soon as that food goes off the shelf, it's either destroyed or made completely inedible.
Yeah.
I mean, have you found that?
In the past, I have found food with either bleach or dye poured all over it. And also, there have been occasions where we've been to places where there's a compressor and they crush the food, which doesn't always work the best of in the best. And some people have been a little bit adventurous in the past and gone in and climbed in and collected some of that food.
Gracious alive. Anyway, back in April, in the run-up to the general election, there were clashes between anarchists and the English Defence League outside the Arnold Feeney, and this was part of one of the TV debates. You're clearly, most anarchists are allied with groups which are against groups like the BNP and the English Defence League. Why do you think that is?
I think the support of prevention of like nationalism, because nationalism actually has a lot of fascist background behind it. People provide dictation over the classes and racial issues that our like country is going through at the moment, and I think anarchists see the solidarity of these other groups and hope to support them in the similar actions that the other organisations do.
Now, the rise of a new right is seen as a big problem, and racism can thrive, can't it, when there's a depression as people look for someone to blame. Now, this is nothing new. Here is whistleblower and former CIA officer Philip Agee, who died recently, speaking on the topic way back in 1995.
They seek to impose very strong, arbitrary, totalitarian government of a neo-fascist stripe. They have simply... These new rightists, starting in the early 1970s, writers in France and Germany, repackaging the fascism of the past to make it more acceptable today. Then, with respect to the violent groups, they are active everywhere. In Britain alone, they had last year about 8,000 incidents based on racism and hate. You've read, no doubt, about the firebombings of the Turkish homes and cultural clubs in Germany by skinheads allied to these neo-Nazi organizations. They calculate there are something like, in Germany alone, 82 different neo-Nazi organizations. And they are being banned from time to time, and then the same groups pop up again with a different name. They are working in harmony with something like 5,000 skinheads in Germany, and they are standing behind and carrying out the dirty work for the two neo-Nazi electoral parties, one called the Republikaner and the other called the German People's Union, both of which parties are believed to have about 25,000 members. The violent scene is thought to include about 43,000 to 45,000 members, and so you're getting up to very close to 100,000 full-time activists in the neo-Nazi scene in Germany. And they are getting away, literally, with murder. But there's no doubt that these groups are growing all the time because of the economic situation in both Europe and in the United States. In Europe, within the European Union, most of the countries of Western Europe, about 385 million people, unemployment is at 12%, which translates into 20 million people unemployed. These people are resentful. They are looking for reasons for their condition, and they are, of course, scapegoating, as they always have. The same thing, or something similar, is happening in the United States with the export of millions of jobs, especially the white men with less education and less skills are wondering what it's all about. They are bewildered, they are alienated, and they are angry.
So that was former CIA officer and whistleblower Philip Agee speaking back in 1995, all that time ago, about the rise of neo-Nazi groups in Europe. Now, Martin, if I can bring you in here, do you think it's alarmist to talk about the BNP, though, as neo-Nazis?
I don't think so. I think we might as well call a spade a spade. I mean, they like to think of themselves as representing mainstream British opinion. I point to the various war memorials around this country, which is littered with the names of people who fought to prevent the views which they represent from triumphing. And I think that their pretensions to patriotism and are deserve to be challenged, and they deserve to be called nasty names, including Nazi.
Well, one of the things that they say now is that they also allow other ethnic groups to join them.
I just think that's a load of hogwash. I mean, the fact of the matter is, what the British National Party's got to understand is if they want to go down the road of the Ulster Loyalists or the Ku Klux Klan, then that is not then that is potential civil war that they're provoking. And they've got to understand that they're allowed to have what they say. I'm allowed to say anything I like about you, but then you've got to take the reaction from the people that you're abusing. And I'm not prepared to tolerate the idea that they can just get away with saying what they think without the consequences. There will be consequences. And the consequences will be, as we saw in Ireland over 30 years, potentially civil war. And that's not for the faint-hearted, is it?
Well, the BNP are a political party. And what about the English Defence League?
Well, they're even worse than the BNP because their politics is essentially street politics of fighting. They're marching on mosques to demand that mosques should be closed down. Now, that's just as bad as what the Nazis did in the 30s in attacking synagogues, and the response has got to be equally robust as far as I'm concerned.
Do you think there are any links between the BNP, English Defence League, and the old sort of old-fashioned National Front in the 1980s?
Well, it's a milieu in which many of these people have grown up, just as on the opposite side of the spectrum, there's a milieu in which people like Kai and myself are operative. I think that I've got no problem with having views about immigration, for example. I think we should have a robust debate about immigration. That's perfectly legitimate. But if you're going to call yourself the British National Party and you're going to march around threatening to attack mosques, well, I'm afraid that's way, way beyond normal political debate. It's like the Loyalists trying to march through Drumcree or Andersonstown. It's a confrontation situation, isn't it? And people get hurt.
Why is it, though, that the Scots have got the SNP, the Welsh have Plaid Cymru, but we have this more racist nationalist party here in England?
Well, it's called the BNP because, of course, they are actually racist towards the Irish, the Scots and the Welsh. If you call it the English National Party, it might be more interesting. But, of course, England is a dominant power. The Serbian National Party in the wars in Yugoslavia was much more unpleasant than the people that they were fighting. Subordinate nations have some right to national representation, whether it's Ireland or Palestine. Dominant powers have to be much more careful about the way they chuck their weight about.
Now, whichever side of the debate you're on, you'll find a lot of literature on these sorts of topics down at the factory. That's just off Portland Square in St Paul's. And Kai's just about still with me here. Kai, can you just tell us what the website is if people want to go on the internet and find out where you are and what you're up to?
Sure. It's freefactory.wordpress.com.
Okay, that's freefactory.wordpress.com, and it's just off Portland Square. Well, that's all for this week. Coming up next is the Sky News at 7 o'clock. Please do join us on Friday Drive Time each week here at BCFM 93.2. If you have a story for us, questions about this evening's programme, or want to suggest a guest for a future show, go to www.thisweek.org.uk or email me at tony@bcfm.org.uk. Thanks very much to our guest in the first hour, Managing Director of Waste Company JTP, that's Julian Parry, and to Kai from the Factory Social Centre in Portland Square. Thanks also to resident old Labour economist Martin Summers and our reporter Marina Morris. If you're on broadband internet, you can hear all our previous Friday drive times, including an hour-long report on mobile phone masts and wireless safety, an extended interview with managing editor of BBC Radio Bristol, Tim Pemberton, and our frustratingly simple five-point economic recovery plan, as well as an investigation into leadership charity Common Purpose and our investigation into the 7/7 London bombings. Just go to thisweek.org.uk and click on the link to our archives. And a podcast of this show is usually available online at by the midnight after broadcast. I'm Tony Gosling, wishing you a relaxing and enjoyable weekend. Now, we have about 60 million people in Britain and 60 million acres of land. So why it might seem that there's not enough resources to go round, that's only because banks and big business have hijacked far more than their fair share. All we have to do is make sure that 60 million acres is shared out fairly, and with modern technology, not controlled by a power elite, we can all live happily together. Do please join us on Friday Drive Time at 5 o'clock next week. And don't let the banksters get you down.
Voice, and it is your choice.
BCFM is the community radio station for Bristol and is here to give everybody in Bristol a voice.